Usually when we talk about a massive jump in productivity, there is this underlying expectation of an automatic reward.
Oh, absolutely.
Like if you're listening to this right now, whether you're, I don't know, on your commute or sitting at your desk, just think about a time recently when you figured out how to use AI to crank your output up, like 10x.
Right. You figure out the prompts, you get the workflow down.
Exactly. You're suddenly shipping code instantly. You're turning around these massive C-suite demo requests in a matter of hours. You are basically tackling every single ad hoc need that pops up on your team.
You become the hero, right?
Yeah. And by all traditional logic, you should be an absolute shoo-in for a promotion.
It seems so obvious. I mean, you become the model workhorse. You are the person they go to when they need something yesterday. And, because of AI, you can actually deliver it.
But then reality hits.
Yeah.
And it turns out, by doing all of this, by being that incredibly fast workhorse, you're hurting your chances.
Yeah, it was wild.
The more output you generate, the more you trap yourself. And today, we are decoding exactly why this happens. Welcome to today's deep dive. We've been going through this really fascinating, honestly kind of counterintuitive piece from the AI Field Notes series.
It's called Too Fast to Promote, right?
Yes, too fast to promote. And it essentially forces us to completely throw out what the author calls the student brain mentality, which, I mean, we all brought that into the workforce, didn't we?
Oh, yeah. We
Yeah.
all did. And it's a really painful habit to break because, well, the behaviors that make you incredibly useful to your boss on a Tuesday are the exact same behaviors that disqualify you from a promotion on a Friday.
Wow. That's rough.
It is,
Yeah.
because that student brain mentality is just deeply ingrained in us. Like in school, the rules are beautifully transparent. You do the homework, you get the answer right, you score high, and you rank up.
Right.
It is a direct one-to-one correlation between effort and reward.
And we carry that straight into the corporate world. We think, I do good work, my boss notices my good work, I get promoted. It's like this addition model.
Yeah.
Good work plus time equals advancement.
Which fundamentally misunderstands what a company actually is.
How so?
Well, a company is not a moral reward system. It just isn't. It doesn't exist to hand out gold stars just because you tried really hard or stayed late on a Thursday.
Right. They don't care about your all-nighters.
Exactly. A company is an environment of intensely limited resources, strict headcount constraints, and very real uncertainty.
Yeah.
So when leadership promotes someone, they are not rewarding past effort. They're making a forward-looking, risk-based decision about who to place into a seat with higher authority and, higher stakes.
Okay, let's unpack this. Because if we were totally throwing out the addition model, the good work plus time thing, what is the actual mechanism?
Right. So the source offers this brutal new equation for advancement, and it shifts everything from addition to multiplication.
Okay, multiplication.
Yeah. It says promotion equals capability times narrative times sponsor motive times org slot times politics and timing.
Wait. Multiplication. I want to push back on that math for a second here.
Go for it.
Are you saying that if I am an absolute rock star at like four of these things, I'm doing great, but one factor is near zero, the whole case just collapses?
It completely collapses.
Wow.
Yeah, that is the genius and frankly, the terror of a multiplicative model. I mean, if this were an addition model or an average, a zero in one category wouldn't really sink you.
Because you could just make up for it elsewhere.
Exactly. You could compensate by working twice as hard in another area, but when you multiply by zero, the entire equation is zero.
So I can't just grind my way through a zero in one of the other columns.
You really can't. Let's say your capability is off the charts, right? And you have a tight narrative, your boss desperately wants to sponsor you, and the timing is absolutely perfect.
Sounds like a slam dunk.
It does, but what if the org slot is zero?
Meaning there's no open position.
Right. There is literally no strategic need for a higher level person in your specific department right now. The result, no promotion.
Oh, I see.
Or, you have the slot, the sponsor, the timing. But your narrative is zero because nobody outside your team actually understands the business impact of what you do. Again, the entire thing equals zero.
That is a massive paradigm shift. It basically frames effort as merely the entry ticket to get into the room, not the master key to unlock the door.
That's a great way to put it. Effort just gets your name on the list to be considered for the math. It does not solve the equation for you.
Okay, so let's dig into the first two variables in that equation, capability and narrative. Because reading through the deep dive materials, this is exactly where AI uniquely sabotages
Oh,
people.
absolutely. It's a huge trap.
The source breaks capability down into two distinct types. There's execution and judgment. And execution is, you know, putting out the fires, answering the prompts, delivering on the requirements.
Doing the thing.
Doing the thing, exactly. Judgment, on the other hand, is defining the problem. It's the ability to say no to things. It is converging a clear direction out of pure ambiguity and, like, turning one isolated success into a repeatable mechanism.
And what's fascinating here is how AI skews this balance.
Right.
AI massively amplifies execution, but it completely obscures judgment. I mean, with AI, you can write docs faster, build project plans faster, write code faster.
Way faster.
But because you are so fast, people just get used to deploying you like a highly efficient tool.
Yeah.
They say, hey, not sure if this idea will work, but toss it to them. They can build a first version by tomorrow.
I actually fell into this exact trap a few years ago.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I thought I was being an absolute hero by turning around these really complex slide decks in like 2 hours using AI.
Sure. You felt like a rock star.
I did. But after a few months, I realized my boss had completely stopped asking for my opinion on the actual content or the strategy. They just treated me like a human API.
A human API. Wow. That hits hard.
It's true. It was just input chaos, output stopgap, input a vague idea, output a polished demo.
And over time, your label in the organization fundamentally shifts when that happens. Leadership doesn't look at you and think, oh, this person has incredible strategic judgment.
Right.
They think, this person can really grind.
Right. Give it to them, they're fast.
Exactly. You've proven you are a strong performer at your current level, but you haven't given them any actual evidence that you are ready to stably and at low risk take on the responsibilities of the next level.
Which totally destroys the second variable narrative.
Yes.
Because if you are just acting as a fast interface, doing, you know, six decent but completely random things in a month, that doesn't prove next level value.
It just proves you're busy.
Exactly. I think about it like a random walk versus a targeted journey. If you take 10 steps in random directions, you've expended a massive amount of energy and you're probably exhausted, but you haven't actually gone anywhere.
You're still in the same spot.
But if you take 10 steps in one deliberate direction, you've actually crossed a boundary.
That is the perfect way to visualize it. Impact on its own does not automatically form a promotion case.
Right.
If you, say, patch an ad hoc database gap on Monday, test a VP's random product idea on Wednesday, and fight a client fire on Friday stacked together, those don't look like a coherent path. They look exactly like a random walk.
So what does the committee see?
The committee reviewing you will just look at it and say, scope isn't clear enough. Impact isn't concentrated.
Ouch.
Which, translated, basically means, I know you're capable, I just don't know what to promote you into.
So how do we fix a broken narrative?
Yeah.
The source outlines what it calls the one-sentence rule.
Yes, this is crucial.
What all your effort has to compress into one single sentence that a promotion committee is literally willing to repeat.
But wait, I have to ask, isn't that just corporate spin?
How do you mean?
Well, if I'm doing a ton of valuable work for the company, why should I have to compress it into some catchy elevator pitch just to get recognized? I mean, it feels a bit superficial, doesn't it? I get that. It feels superficial until you understand the mechanics of how a promotion committee actually operates.
Okay, tell me.
You have to remember, the people deciding your fate are usually several layers removed from your daily work. They don't see the late nights. They are reviewing dozens of packets in a single afternoon.
Right.
They might have, what, 5 minutes to allocate to your entire year's worth of effort?
That's terrifying.
It is. So if your manager goes in there and says, they built a lot of AI demos and worked really hard, the committee has nothing to grasp.
There's no hook.
Exactly. The one sentence rule is about translating your work into the value language that the organization rewards.
So give me an example. What does that translation sound like in practice?
Sure. So instead of a list of tasks like, they built AI demos, the sentence needs to be a thesis of structural impact.
Okay.
Something like, they turned our team's AI exploration from gut feel trial and error into an invaluable, reusable, scalable discovery engine.
Oh, wow. I see the difference. The first one makes me sound like a mechanic turning a wrench. The second one makes me sound like the engineer who completely redesigned the factory floor.
Precisely. It proves you're working at a higher scope.
But even if you do that,
right?
Even if you use AI to build a perfect narrative of judgment and compress it into that golden sentence, you can still hit a brick wall.
Oh, yeah. The rest of the equation.
Right. And that brings us to the hidden machinery of this multiplicative equation. Sponsors, slots, and politics.
Mm.
Here's where it gets really interesting. The source makes a brilliant distinction between a mentor, a supporter, and a sponsor, because we totally tend to conflate those.
And we do all the time. And it's a fatal career mistake.
Yeah.
A mentor is someone who gives you advice over coffee. A supporter is someone who says nice things about you to your face or, you know, hits like on your project updates.
Good to have, but not enough.
Exactly. But a sponsor. A sponsor is a political investor. They are willing to spend their own hard-earned political capital on your advancement.
They aren't just a cheerleader. To be a sponsor, the tech says they need three specific things.
Right.
First, power. Do the people on the promotion committee actually defer to them? Second, the willingness to spend that power. Like, when you're not in the room, will they stand up, bang the table, and say, I will personally carry the risk for this person?
Yes. And that's huge.
But it's the third piece that really surprised me, motive. Because, and this hurts to hear, deserving it isn't a motive.
No, it's not. And it's the most pragmatic and honestly the most overlooked part of the equation. The sponsor has to have a problem that your promotion solves.
Right.
Ask yourself, why do they need you promoted? What organizational risk does putting you in a higher seat lower for them?
What's in it for them?
Exactly. Which bigger charter can you own so they can focus their attention elsewhere? If the only answer you can come up with is, because I worked hard and deserve it, your sponsor's motive is incredibly weak.
Wow.
And when push comes to shove in that committee room and another executive is fighting tooth and nail for their own candidate, your sponsor will just fold.
Which is why you can't rely on merit alone.
Nope.
But let's say a sponsor is desperate to promote you to solve their own headaches. They can't magically create a chair that doesn't exist.
Right, the org slot.
Exactly. The company has to actually need that role.
Okay.
And that's where the math usually breaks down for high performers. Let's make this concrete.
Let's do it.
Let's say we have a developer, Sarah. She's on a legacy maintenance team. She uses AI to clear a 50-ticket backlog in a single week.
Impressive execution.
Right. Incredible execution. But a month later, she watches a colleague on the new product team who built just one new feature get promoted over her. Why does Sarah's equation equal zero here?
It's a really painful scenario, but it is so common. Sarah is caught in the local optimization trap.
Okay.
She is working incredibly hard, but the environment she is in, that maintenance team, is structurally limited to short-term support and putting out fires.
Yeah.
It is almost impossible in that specific environment for her to prove she changed a system or defined a new direction or owned an org-level problem. The scope just isn't there.
Because it's just maintenance.
Right. The organization doesn't have a slot for a strategic visionary on a team designed merely to keep the lights on.
So she's just grinding harder, swinging her sword faster, but the marginal return is practically zero because she's fighting on the wrong battlefield.
Yes. If the organization has no slot big enough to accommodate the narrative you're trying to build, no matter how strong your capability is, you will only ever be used as a more senior tool.
Mm.
And this completely explains a phenomenon I'm sure you've seen. You know someone who is stuck at a mid-level for years, they get frustrated, they switch companies, and boom, they get promoted to director almost instantly.
I've always wondered about that. I used to think, like, did they just get magically smarter over the weekend?
No, they didn't get stronger or smarter overnight. They just moved to an environment that actually had a slot that could explain, utilize, and reward their value.
They removed the zero from their equation.
Exactly.
Okay, so we have capability, narrative, sponsor motive, and org slot. The final multiplier in the sources equation is politics and timing.
Right.
And I know the word politics immediately makes people cringe. Like, we picture schmoozing at happy hours, flattering the boss, or engaging in some Machiavellian maneuvering.
But Muffus politics.
Yeah. But the text redefines politics in a really clinical, objective way. It calls it distributed consensus.
Which is a much healthier, more accurate way to look at it. The higher you go in any organization, the less a single manager gets to decide your fate.
Right.
Politics is simply the reality of multiple power nodes making a collective risk judgment on whether you can handle more authority.
So it's not just your boss.
No, there might be a skip-level manager, a VP from a tangential department, a calibration committee. And if those people only know you as a useful, fast person, or worse, if they feel their own team will lose resources if you get promoted out of your current role, they are going to veto.
So how do you actually handle that? The source talks about pre-wiring 6 to 12 months in advance.
Yeah.
But how do you do that without coming across like you're just playing dirty office politics?
Well, pre-wiring isn't about taking executives to play golf.
Okay, good.
It's about strategic visibility. It means if you know the VP of sales has veto power over your promotion in December, you don't wait for December for them to see your name on a slide.
Right, that's way too late.
Exactly. In June, you invite them to a 15-minute sync to show how the AI tool you built specifically solved a data problem for their sales team.
Oh, that's smart.
Yeah, and you ask for their feedback. You are functionally feeding them the evidence they need to say yes 6 months later. You digest their doubts about you early, so your sponsor is walking into the review holding material that everyone is already aligned around.
Okay, this brings us to the crucial part.
Mm-hmm.
So what does this all mean? If you're listening to this, you understand the traps now. You see the hidden machinery.
You know the math.
Right.
Yeah.
But how do you practically manage other people's mental models of you? How do you upgrade yourself from being this human agent runner to an actual strategic decision maker?
Yeah, how do you get out of the trap?
Exactly. The source outlines a very clear four-step playbook, and I want us to really dig into each of these. The first step, write the thesis first.
Right. This is about shifting from reactive to proactive.
Okay.
Do not wait until the end of the year, look at a massive pile of scattered projects, and ask, how do I package this?
Which is what everyone does.
It is. But you need to define the promotion thesis before you even take on the work. You sit down in January and ask yourself, what is the core evidence I need to prove I belong at the next level? And which projects will jointly prove that thesis?
So you are proactively building the through line.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to retroactively draw a line through a bunch of random dots.
Exactly.
That makes a lot of sense. Which leads into the second step, which I think is going to terrify some people.
Yeah.
Implementing high-grade pushback.
Oh, people hate this one.
The advice is to stop unconditionally rewarding people for tossing requests at you. But wait, people are terrified of pushback. They think their boss will see them as uncooperative or difficult or, you know, not a team player.
Right.
What does this actually sound like in practice? Give me a scenario.
Let's do a role play. Say a VP drops a vague request on your desk at 4 p.m. on a Thursday. They say, hey, can you use AI to spin up a quick dashboard showing our customer churn metrics by tomorrow?
Panic sets in.
Right. Now, low-grade pushback, which you absolutely want to avoid, is saying, I'm too busy, or that's not my job. That does make you look uncooperative.
Yeah, don't say that.
But high-grade pushback elevates the problem. You look at the VP and ask, I can absolutely build that. But what specific business decision is this dashboard meant to answer?
Oh, yeah.
Or who is going to adopt it once it's done? Is there a cheaper way to test this hypothesis before we build a whole dashboard?
Oh, I love that. You aren't slowing down the work or refusing it.
Nope.
You are showing your judgment before you show your execution. You are upgrading yourself from a blind executor to a thought partner.
Exactly. You're changing their mental model of you.
Which transitions perfectly into the third step of the playbook.
Mm.
Turn delivery into judgment evidence. When you finish a project, you don't just say, here's the result. You have to show the math.
Right. When you present the final product, you spend time explaining the reasoning. You detail the alternative directions you actively ruled out and why.
Okay.
Highlight the hidden risks you found along the way and how you mitigated them. If you only show the polished result, people only see execution evidence.
They just see the fast output.
Exactly. If you show the why and the how, it becomes next level evidence. It proves your brain was involved in the architecture, not just your hands in the assembly.
And the final piece of this playbook is actively managing the sponsor's motive.
Mm-hmm.
We talked earlier about how deserving it isn't a motive.
Right.
So you have to change the conversation you have with your manager. You stop asking, hey, what do I need to do to get promoted? And you start asking, what systemic problems do you need someone to solve over the next year to support your upcoming priorities?
Yes.
You are literally handing them the motive to fight for you.
You are helping them write the exact sentence they will use to defend you in the committee room. You want them to be able to say, look, I need this person promoted because we have a massive data migration looming, and they are the only one who has proven they can systematically manage that risk.
That argument is bulletproof compared to, they answer emails really fast on weekends.
It really is. It shifts the entire dynamic of how you are perceived.
It reminds me of this incredible maritime analogy from the text. The author points out that in the AI era, the technology allows you to do a lot more of the rowing.
Right.
You can row faster, harder, and longer than ever before. But the true leverage and the promotion goes to the one who is navigating and steering the ship. When you use AI to row faster, you're just a stronger engine.
Yeah.
But the captain doesn't get promoted for having a strong engine. They get promoted for knowing how to avoid the iceberg.
That is the ultimate takeaway from all of this. In this new era, execution is getting cheaper by the day. AI just commoditizes the rowing.
Yeah, it really does.
And when output is cheap, simply being fast is no longer a scarce resource. What is incredibly scarce, like the only thing left that truly matters, is the layer of judgment behind that output.
Defining the right problem to solve in the first place.
Organizing the resources. Turning random, fast effort into actual strategic outcomes.
So the danger isn't being too slow anymore. The danger is being so incredibly fast that nobody bothers to understand your head. You just become this blur of output.
The very useful blur.
Exactly. So for everyone listening, you have to ask yourself a really hard question. Are you defining problems or are you just taking them? If you were gone tomorrow, would your company lose a critical strategic capability or would they just lose a very busy person?
It's a brutal question to confront, honestly, but it's the only one that matters if you want to move up in an environment where speed is no longer special.
And I want to leave you with one final kind of chilling thought that ripples out from all of this source material. Just think about the trajectory of the technology.
Right.
If you fall into this trap, if you act merely as a fast interface for your boss, inputting their vague requirements and outputting code or slide decks, what happens in 2, 3, or 5 years?
When the AI can just do it itself.
Exactly. When AI agents become entirely capable of running those exact workflows themselves without needing a human interface in the middle.
Yeah.
If you don't upgrade from the workhorse to the navigator right now, you might not just miss out on a promotion. You might find that the very AI you use to speed up your execution is the exact same AI that replaces your seat entirely.
Wow.
You have to keep steering. Until next time, keep diving deep.